Welcome to episode 3 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. As a special note, this episode is being recorded in the Gimbel Special Collections Room at the Air Force Academy's McDermott Library. Our guest today is Dr. Tony Tingle. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, currently serving as the Program Director for the Air Force Academy's Institute for Future Conflict. Tony earned his PhD from George Mason University and has written on a variety of topics ranging from next-generation warfare to high-altitude military operations. Read that as balloons. And that was 3 years before the country's attention turned to mainland China's balloon overflights of the U.S. So you were well ahead of that issue. Similarly, today, Tony's research is focused on the war in Ukraine and the implications for future warfare. As with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity, and should not be construed to do so. So with that as an introduction, welcome, Tony. Let's talk about your research. What prompted you, other than it's in the headlines, but specifically, what made you want to turn your research focus to Ukraine?
Thanks, Darren. I started in 2021. I was writing a book. Academics like to use the term book project, which I hate that term. But I was writing a book on the military-industrial complex. And the war started in February 2022. And we started looking at Ukraine, obviously, really closely. And it took up so much of my time that I decided, well, I'm going to put this other book on hold and I will just write a book on Ukraine, because there was a lot of knowledge gaps that I had about the Cold War, about some of the geopolitics of Eastern Europe that I was not familiar with. And I said, well, if I write a book explaining the war in Ukraine, that will probably fill in some knowledge gaps for me too.
So. Okay. So before we jump into what's going on right now, given that interesting insight is how you got started, what do you see as some of the important leftovers or foundational pieces of the Cold War, which presented the, or set up the war in Ukraine right now?
Yeah, I think the number one lesson from history prior to 2022 is probably just the nature of Russian imperialism. I think it's somehow ingrained in Putin, in the Russian Federation and the Soviet Empire. I think for whatever reason, they believe that there is a historic foundation for Russian expansionism. Okay. I just think that from the Bolsheviks, from the Russian Empire, from the Soviet Union, I think it's just a historic common denominator.
Did you ever read George Kennan's Long Telegram?
Oh, yeah.
Or X article?
Yep.
Yeah, we used those in a class last semester. Probably it would be very similar to what you're looking at now. And Kennan would be smiling that his work is still relevant, because he applied, from his view, that sort of was a Russian thing that made its imprint on the Soviet Union. Even though the Soviet Union's Marxist, they were still doing certain things, driven by whatever, historical forces, passions. You can, apply some other disciplinary framework to explain it, but it's interesting that you would say that's still a thing.
Yeah, I think one of the things, one of the salient points of the Long Telegraph from Kennan is that they only respond to might. Really, the strength. Might is right when it comes to the Soviet Union, now Russia and Putin. And Putin has this kind of mafioso background, kind of, tough guy attitude.
Yeah.
And, unless you respond with strength. And that was one of the problems, one of the failures of deterrence, I think, in 2021, leading into the war. We just did not have a good show of strength. We had a weak, embarrassing retreat from Afghanistan. We had a elderly kind of, I don't know how to put it politely, Joe Biden gives off an air of feebleness. And when he vacillated in terms of, well, what kind of invasion is it? Is it a full invasion? You know, when he said that line about our response to a possible Russian invasion, he said, well, okay, well, I don't know. It depends on what kind of invasion it is. It was just a show of weakness. And I think that coupled with the Ukrainian army's display of ineptitude from 2014-2015, basically that would have been a perfect time for Putin to take over Ukraine.
Well, I guess it's important to make a recent historical note that in terms of defining your terms, would you... You mentioned the invasion, but is it accurate to say that the war in Ukraine really started in 2014?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because there was a lot of fighting that, you know, people perhaps didn't pay attention to in those eastern republics that the Russians invaded. And there was the Little Green Men invasion of Crimea and all that in 2014. So that set a precedent for, you know, the West not reacting firmly and probably... talked about deterrence, probably was a contributing factor in deterrence not holding when they decided to push farther. Would you say that's correct?
Oh, for sure. So, yeah, I think, and probably every non-occupied Ukrainian right now would probably agree with that statement that the war definitely started in 2014. As a little background, so when it really actually started in 2004 with the Orange Revolution. So Viktor Yushchenko and Viktor Yanukovych were vying for the presidency in 2004. Yushchenko was poisoned mysteriously with digoxin or dioxin, which caused his face to basically look like an alligator.
Yeah, he looked very scaly.
Yes.
Basically destroyed his facial complexion.
Yeah, it was terrible. But Yushchenko was caught basically cheating on the election through wiretaps or telephone intercepts or something like that. And he won the election, but fraudulently. And then thousands of people turned out in the Maidan, which is the city center, Independence Square of the center of Kyiv, protesting. It was called the Orange Revolution after Yushchenko's campaign colors were orange. And because of those protests, the Supreme Court of Ukraine overturned the election results, and they had a new election, and Yushchenko won. But in order to overturn the election results, he had to make concessions with his opposing party, with which the head of that was, I think she was the head of, it was Yulia Tymoshenko.
Tymoshenko, yes.
I think she was the head of the opposition party that was not, Yanukovych's party. I know this is confusing because there's a lot of Viktors and Yanukovych's and Yushchenko's. But long story short, he had to make, Viktor Yushchenko had to make some concessions with parliament to share power, as I understand it. And because he had to do that, he was not able to enact reforms in the way that his supporters expected. So long story short, and this is, to me, this is amazing. In 2010, Yanukovych, the guy that poisoned his opponent, cheated on the election, ran again for president. So did Yulia Tymoshenko. But he won the presidency in 2010, and he was a pro Russia Kremlin-backed candidate.
Right.
So that's just amazing. That just goes to, you know, you think American politics are crazy, but Ukrainian politics are probably just as bad.
I remember some of the electoral maps from that, which kind of show the breakdown where you might say they're battle lines now. The deepest blue blocks were in those eastern republics, which the Russians subsequently invaded. Mm-hmm. And consequently, as you moved farther to the west, the more pro-European camp, which was Tymoshenko's, They clearly started to win. Middle ground around Kyiv was sort of a little bit more mixed.
Yeah.
But when you got into the western area, and when you're all the way out of Lviv, it was solidly, you know, like 70-80% in favor of the pro-European Union Western model. So that cleavage was there, and people look at the election results from that map. They can kind of see some of those fault lines. And Crimea, of course, was, you know, deep blue, reflecting support for the pro-Moscow candidate.
Yeah, pretty much. If you were to draw a line from north to south in Ukraine, as I understand it, you would probably start at Kharkiv and draw that line straight to Odessa, and everything on the east of that line would be probably, for the most part, pro-Russian. I mean, it's much more complicated than this. But that eastern side would be pro-Russian. And it's different, varying degrees of, pro-Russianhood or whatever.
Pro-Russian sentiment, right?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, that goes back to what you were saying earlier about the sort of consistency of Russian imperial behavior, you know, that transcends, you know, the shift from the czars to the Soviet Union and now Putin. There's remarkable consistency, it would seem, to outside observers that, you know, they're kind of maintaining the same sentiment about wanting to extend their influence to the West. And those layers revealed by the voting blocks, I think the easternmost would be those that had been most settled the longest under the czars, and then as they move westward, and then the farthest west, that was a territory acquired after the Second World War, carved out of Poland and such, added to the Ukraine or Belarus.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just a pattern. That's what Kennan was looking at back in 46, 47, and you're seeing that again today.
I think it has more to do with economic forces. So if you live in the eastern part, you have a closer economic ties to Russia. And if you live in the western Ukraine, you have, you know, stronger ties to Europe. And then in Crimea, I think that's probably more historically oriented towards Russia. And Crimea that's the special case. So that's really the crux of a lot of this, is Crimea. Clearly, Putin believes it's Russian. Khrushchev gave Crimea as basically a gift to Ukraine in, I think, 46? No, it must have been after that. So, 56?
54, mid-50s. So, it was sort of one of those things he did early in his rule as this post-Stalin Soviet premier.
According to Putin and most Russian-leaning historians, I guess it was a symbolic gesture. But I would say Crimea, you know, the Turks probably have as much historic claim to Crimea as the Russians or the Ukrainians.
Now, them's probably real fighting words there.
I mean, yeah, that's...
You weren't planning on going back, were you?
I think the Crimean question is probably going to be the crux of the negotiations, unless another miracle happens where the Ukrainians somehow completely defeat the Russians, handedly. Without that that kind of victory, I think what to do with Crimea is probably going to be high on the list of negotiation topics, because it seems to be a pretty hard red line for Putin. Most of Crimea was before 2022 was most of the population considered themselves Russian. I think the number is like 67% of Crimeans considered themselves ethnic Russians. And I think 99%, I'm not sure about this number, but an overwhelming number of Crimeans spoke Russian as their first language. It was very high.
And I think part of that, again, goes back to, return to your opening comments about the consistency across Russian governments, whether it's Tsarist, Soviet, or now Putin. I believe the fact that you have, a large Russian population there is because under the Soviets, they simply deported all, mm-hmm. local, I think they're called Crimean Tatars,
mm-hmm.
and shipped them off to camps in Siberia,
yep.
and forcibly moved in the Russian population. So it's not surprising that you would have that kind of presence and loyalty. Other countries have done that in the past as part of a settlement project. So that's part of the undergirding history there,
mm-hmm.
which again is not surprisingly, I imagine, one of those grievances of Ukrainians against the Russians today, because it's rooted in that historical action under the Soviets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Stalin deported all the Tatars,
yep.
or tried to deport all the Tatars.
Enough to certainly shift the makeup and the allegiance of the area.
Yeah, I mean, the Soviet Union has always tried, in, as far as I know, to Sovietize the republics. So if you got, my understanding, if you got, let's say, a college education in Ukraine, you were required to go to one of the other republics, so one of the stands, or Russia proper, to do an internship for 4 or 5 years. So they were trying to intermix everybody in the USSR.
To prevent the rise of competing nationalities.
Probably they didn't want a strong national sense, yes. And Ukraine has always had that, I think, in the back burner, that sense of nationality that they haven't been able to exercise, whether it was in, 19, the early 1920s, when they were petitioning not to be part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Whether it was during World War II, when the Nazis basically invaded Ukraine, and then the Russians invaded Ukraine again from the other side and pushed the Nazis back.
I think the Ukrainians, some Ukrainian units, fought against reincorporation of the Soviet Union for a couple of years. And that was also true in the Baltics.
So the Ukrainian, I might kill this, the Ukrainian Liberation Army, ULA, I don't really want to get into that topic, but that's a very contentious topic because some of those guys and women fought with the Nazis. And then they fought against the Nazis, and then they fought against the Soviets. So that's a pretty contentious topic. Stefan Bandera, I think his name is. He was the leader of the kind of the insurgency for a while.
Yeah.
And some people point to him as proof positive that there are neo-Nazis in Ukraine.
I think it's certainly useful for the Russian propaganda machine to point to that and use it for its own purposes.
But I believe he died in a Nazi concentration camp, or he was held in a prisoner of war camp. There's lots of competing facts and competing, if you call them facts, but there's a lot of competing ideas behind. Surely there's neo-Nazis in Ukraine, just like there's plenty of neo-Nazis in Russia. And Germany, and America.
So, well, that is a background on history, and thanks for that sort of survey as to sort of what brought us here. Looking at the implications for future warfare, what's going on now and what you think is significant, which I think is what's going to be the focus of your book you started talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your early observations and maybe conclusions about where you think this is going for Ukraine, and then if we have some time, we might either make this a long episode or I could split it in two later on. What are the implications for conflict elsewhere? But as you see Ukraine right now, what strikes you as someone coming from the U.S. Army background and now, mm-hmm. For us, the Air Force here, looking at future conflict as an area of academic study?
So the way I break it down, looking at the war, is just pretty much in domains. So look at the land domain, look at the naval domain, the sea domain, look at air, how air power is faring, space, cyber, information warfare. So let's just take the land warfare component first. It might be too early to make any strong lessons about some of the major components of combined arms warfare when it comes to land warfare. The one that always comes up is the tank dead? Or is the armored column dead? And I go back and forth on this, but there is no evidence right now to support that the tank is going to be useful in future conflict. And there's nothing to say that that I've seen so far that says that because they had armored vehicles versus maybe a Humvee with a 50 cal on top, mm-hmm. which is a not armored. It's a Humvee is just basically a oversized Jeep. They do have light armor, but on some of them, but I don't see any evidence to support the efficacy of armor on the battlefield yet. The Russians have lost, I think the last number I saw was 2,000 tanks, not armored vehicles, not BMPs or infantry fighting vehicles, but actual tanks. We might be at a technological crossroads or a tipping point with handheld man pads, anti-tank guided missiles, where the technology has just reached a threshold where now, and that happens in history, where you just reach a tipping point where this technology is just dominant over previous technologies. And we might be there because you can reach out pretty far with a TOW, which is a wire-guided, optically tracked anti-tank missile. Javelins and LAWs, they have their capability now to penetrate the reactive armor of tanks, to hit a tank on the fly, to hit it on the soft top of the tank instead of, where the armor is heaviest. I think one of the lessons of ground warfare might be that the tank is dead. I would have said that the helicopter is definitely dead, but that's the jury's still out on that because the last week, the counteroffensive, one of the things that, and again, it's too early to call on the, this summer's counteroffensive, but one of the things we saw early on last week was that the Ukrainians were having a problem with helicopters and air.
What kind of problems?
They were just taking out the tanks and the Bradleys. They either don't have Stinger missiles in those forward scouting kind of probing columns, or there's some other problem with the counter air that we don't know about right now. Russia may have figured something out. That's always a possibility. But I think it's more likely that some of these forward columns just didn't have Stinger missiles or whatever, Iglas, which is a Soviet-era man pad, because a lot of the Stingers and LAWs, Javelins, a lot of those weapons early on did not get pushed down to the forward units in Ukraine.
What were they held in reserve for defensive Kyiv?
No, they weren't. I believe that most of them were held at the higher levels. So Special Operations Forces and the GUR, which is their military intelligence, which also has an operational arm. So I think a lot of those were held At higher levels. And then when you get down to the active army, the territorial defense, the National Guard, the volunteer brigades, they didn't, you mentioned the defense of Kyiv, they didn't have those until the very last moment. So what they used mostly in the defense of Kyiv, or at least the people that I talked to at the 72nd MEK Brigade that defended Kyiv, RPG-7s.
Wow.
Yeah. They were using old school rocket-propelled grenades.
Not against wire-guided anything, nothing. Just aim it.
Nope. 300-meter range, jump out of the woods and hit the tank and then run.
And I assume they had those in quantity, so they were shooting them rather liberally.
Yeah. The stories I were told was they did get NLAWs like a day before their ambush. They didn't know how to use them.
So thanks for that overview of the land domain. What would you have to say about the air domain in Ukraine right now?
Yeah, so early on, that was one of the curious things about the VKS, which is the Russian Air Force. So everybody wondered what happened to the Russian Air Force and why they're not, doing combined arms like we would do with a land component. Okay. There's a couple reasons why the VKS was not as effective after the initial thrust into Ukraine. One of the reasons was that Ukraine was able at the last minute to move a lot of their air defense systems. A lot of them got blown up. So a lot of the Buk and a lot of the S-300s were destroyed in the initial attack, but a lot of them made it out. They were able to move them and hide them and then use them effectively eventually. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason is that things like Stingers, they work. So there's plenty of videos online of Stingers taking out KH-52 Alligator helicopters, which is the most advanced Russian attack helicopter, Mi-8 Hips, and Stingers work. So early on in the war, the Russians did not, my understanding is they don't have a lot of precision-guided munitions for their Air Force. So that leaves either lofting bombs from a long way off, or getting real close and low and trying to hit targets with bombs. And I think that lends itself to the 13,000 feet max for a Stinger, and I might be wrong on that number, but that also lends itself to taking out Russian air forces. Other than that, Russia has pretty much kept their air force in reserve. I think they're at, I think the number is 85% of their air force is still viable.
Okay.
Which may be a problem moving forward for the Ukrainians. So if they do happen to expend all their strategic air defenses, like the NASAMS and the Iris-T and the Patriots, and their S-300s, the Ukrainian S-300s, and the Ukrainian Buk systems. And Russia starts getting free rein of the air domain, air superiority, and starts to support ground forces. That's going to be a problem for Ukraine, both on the offense and the defense.
But as yet, neither side really has had any pretensions of even going for air superiority at this point. So they've kind of had to deal with a very contested environment.
Right. I mean, it started in 2015, or probably before that, 2014. Ukraine started becoming one of the most heavily defended air, territories in the world. And we saw that in, I think, 2014, when the Russians brought in one of the Buk systems into the Donbas, right between Luhansk and Donetsk. And because the Ukrainians were using IL-76 transport cargo planes to drop their airborne troops into the contested Donbas areas against the rebels. And so the Russians brought forward these air defense systems. And they had, the week before the Malaysian airline got shot down, they had shot down a Ukrainian IL-76 in the same exact location. And a week later, for whatever reason, the Malaysian Airlines and the European agency that allows overflights decided it was okay to let the Malaysian Airlines MH17 fly right over the most contested airspace in the world at the time. And the Russians shot it down and killed almost 300 people, everybody aboard.
That was a terrible, terrible shoot down.
Yep. And that's when it wasn't until that shoot down that the West started getting serious about sanctions.
Right.
They started really trying to turn the screws on Russians at that point.
What about the other domains? So there's been some activity in sea attacks on like the Moskva and such. And early on, there was discussion of interference with Starlink and other commercial space-based systems. Mm-hmm. What activities in those domains have some implication for future conflict, as you would see?
Yeah, so in the naval domain, in the sea domain, what we saw early on, we saw the Russians got a little aggressive with their destroyers, and the Moskva was the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet for Russia. It got a little too close to Odessa, and the Ukrainians have an indigenous anti-ship missile called the Neptune. And I think it has a 200-mile range. I could be wrong on that, but it's about 200 miles. Anyways, long story short, they used two of these Neptune missiles to sink the Moskva. And after that, the Russians pulled back to Sevastopol, which is their naval base in Crimea, pretty much kept their naval assets kind of protected in Crimea. Well, the Ukrainians started using an unmanned surface vessel, which is basically a remote control boat filled with explosives. And they attacked Sevastopol. And I can't remember when that happened. But they used a couple of those and some TB2 Turkish drones.
Right.
To attack some of these ships in the ad doc, I guess, for lack of a better term, in Sevastopol. Other than that, the naval battle has pretty much been Russia using their missile destroyers to launch cruise missiles from their ships to attack basically Ukrainian cities and civilians.
Now, you mentioned there drones, and we probably left the air domain too quickly because we didn't address drones. And I know you mentioned in our earlier conversation that you looked at some drones and quadcopters and stuff as part of research. So what would you tell folks listening about the employment of drones on either side by the Ukrainians or Russian forces?
Yeah, that's really one of the big stories of this war. It started... it started probably, I first heard of Ukrainians and Russians dropping grenades off of quadcopters, I think it was 2015. So this has been going on for a while. This is not a new technological development. I mean, it's going on, been going on for 9 years at least. I think the Armenians used it too.
The Azeris were using it against the Armenians, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah, in that conflict. But yeah, that's the big story. And this is a technological cat and mouse game where the Ukrainians come up with some innovation and the Russians get hurt by it for a while and then they adapt. So the Russians are not very good at innovating. but they're okay at adapting Ukrainian innovations or adapting to Ukrainian innovations. So early on, we saw, I mentioned the Bayraktar TB2, which is the Ukrainian large drone, like kind of like our Predator and Reaper. That had a lot of success early on. And then the Russians just adapted to it, both in electronic warfare and kinetic means. So you don't hear a lot about that anymore because they just kind of adapted to the larger drones. The smaller drones, or you can see every day there's a new video of a drone dropping a grenade on somebody. They adapted... the most popular one, if I'm correct, is what I was told in Ukraine. The most popular drone quadcopter is the Mavic 3. And they've adapted that to drop a grenade on a target. But it has, it's really changed warfare, having small drones and a lot of them. I think the number recently came out, Ukraine's losing 10,000 commercial drones or small drones a month. That's an outrageous
number.
Per month. Yeah, it's an outrageous number. Drones are basically becoming like hand grenades. You just throw them and you forget about
disposable.
It.
Disposable.
Yeah, they're gone.
Certainly they're consumable items.
Yeah, but the if you want to call it a revolution in military affairs, which purists would probably scoff at that, but the revolution really is having the ability for small, real small units, like squad size units, to see not necessarily over the horizon or over the next hill, but just to see 30 feet in the air. Like that's when you're talking trench warfare, the ability to see 10 feet above the ground is exponential to what you see when you're hiding in a mud trench.
That's interesting because, you know, classically across centuries, the idea of controlling the high ground and being on like the military crest, mm-hmm. you could observe things below on terrain, the drone is allowing people to, at least from a visual perspective, create their own crest to look over. So the mm-hmm. control of terrain isn't as geographically limited, perhaps. So that's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and it the ability to see just a little bit above the ground is creating a bunch of new TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures for the infantry. Beyond just using those drones as either in a kamikaze mode. To attack vehicles and infantry, dropping grenades. There's a popular story, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and this video came out maybe 3 weeks ago, where one of the Russian soldiers surrendered to a drone. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
Yeah.
He basically drops his gun, takes his helmet off, does all kinds of visual signaling to say, I'm not a combatant, I surrender. Don't drop a grenade on me.
Yep.
And I understand the Ukrainians then got him.
I think they sent him a note via drone.
How to turn himself in.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Where to go. But beyond the kinetic, just the attack part of it, they're using those drones to see over the trench. For example, to see over the trench. You can see when your trench is getting assaulted by the Russians, for example, and then they use that as a timing mechanism to throw grenades or landmines, literally landmines, over the trench to the attacking infantry. So it is not only physically changing, but mentally it's changing the game, how we perceive the battle space from a small unit's tactics kind of perspective.
And if incoming offensive fires are designed to keep the defenders' heads down and blind them, they can send up a drone or two or three as consumables and not have their heads down and not be blinded during that barrage or whatever suppressive fire. So that, imagine
exactly,
that.
Exactly, because how trench warfare has been conducted in the past up until now is you lead with a barrage of artillery or mortar fire. You try to keep everybody's head down. But what usually happens is you lead with the artillery. Everybody goes into their bunker. And then everybody knows when the artillery stops, you've got about a minute to get to your positions and start firing on the advancing infantry. And that's why offensively, it's hard to conduct a, you know, blow the whistle, jump over the trench and attack.
So in essence, I'm going to make a very broad statement here, which you can pick apart from your expertise. That sort of making, reinforcing the World War I-esque aspects of this and making it more difficult for an offensive to actually break through?
Maybe, but I think it works both ways. Because you can use a grenade, a drone with a grenade, after the, for example, after the artillery barrage, to keep them in their bunker. So I could keep dropping drone grenades.
Okay.
And to keep them pinned down while the infantry advances. I think the reason why we're in this World War I stalemate is not so much because of the technology. So like in World War I, barbed wire and trenches themselves were a technology that facilitated trench warfare. So because they had trenches, it just naturally created trench warfare. Because you couldn't, like I said, you couldn't advance. But as everybody knows, we kind of broke that paradigm at the end of World War I with the tank. So I think the stalemate that we have now is not so much because they just can't advance. It's because that's basically where the Ukrainian counteroffensive in late summer last year and fall ended up. So they advanced to some rivers, and they kind of just stopped the counteroffensive. And then when you stop, then you dig in, and that's where they've dug in a lot of places.
And the rivers are a natural boundary.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, to try it's an and, obstacle.
Restrict the movement of troops.
Yeah.
So, okay. We could go on, obviously. We could dedicate multiple episodes to this as it's an emerging area of interest. Do you have any final thoughts about the implications for future warfare beyond Ukraine? I mean, it's still clearly there's a lot to be played out in the battle for Ukraine and against the Soviet invading forces. But if we look at other areas, where might some of these lessons be applied?
Yeah, a couple of things on that. I think first, I think we're in it for the long haul here. I don't think this war is going to be over anytime soon. So when you talk about future conflict and lessons from the Ukrainian war on future conflict, I think it will be the future conflict. I think it's reasonable to see this war go on for five more years. I think the Ukrainian Minister of Cyber Warfare, or something like that, he just said a couple days ago that he believes it'll go on for 10 years, the hot shooting war. So when we talk about the future conflict, this thing could go on for a long time. You have, and why is that? Because Putin wants it to. You have a madman that has pretty strong popular support at home for the war, and there's lots of reasons for that. But he has pretty strong popular support. He's got a population that's three times the population of Ukraine. He's got basically an endless revenue stream of oil to support his military endeavors. He's got an underground supply line from dual-use technologies from India, Pakistan, Iran, China, that will continue to equip his military. And at the very least, he's got nuclear weapons. So you put all those together, and you've got a guy like that that wants a war of attrition. He's going to get a war of attrition. And that's why I think it's going to last for a long time.
Well, it's good foreshadowing, because my next two podcast episodes are probably going to be with people that are going to talk about the role of nuclear weapons in international relations. Sure. So that's a good segue to that. So let me thank you for your thoughts and insights from your experience in researching Ukraine, and close what's become sort of the final question here I'm asking everybody. And that is, in the next 5 years, what change or trend in international or domestic politics, economics, law, technology, which you talked a lot about here, or even culture, will have the greatest impact on national security, in your opinion?
Our national security.
U.S. national security. Bring it back to, I'm presuming here is mostly a home side.
Sure. I would say the U.S. defense budget.
The defense budget? Okay.
I think people are finally going to wake up to the fact that we have we're on the glide path for $1 trillion per year defense budget.
Okay.
And I think people are going to realize, and legislators too, lawmakers are going to come to the realization that that's unsustainable, and we need to take a deeper look into how we spend our defense dollars. And I think it's reasonable to see a $500 billion defense budget in the next 5 years.
So a 50% cut.
I think so, yeah. Oh. And I think that might be done through surreptitious means, like sequestration. So they make the defense budget and sequestration dependent on other things that are not necessarily connected to the defense budget directly.
So that would be part of a larger deal, a trade-off, yeah, like it was in sequestration, which I think was 2012,
yeah,
13
times. Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah. You know, they were holding a gun to their head, and they're like, no one's going to pull the trigger. We'll get this deal done. But they didn't, and sequestration took effect. And I think in this latest legislation they just passed to balance the budget, or not balance the budget, for the budget, to pass a budget.
The debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling, yeah. I think there's a sequestration-type clause in there for defense. But that's what I would say.
Interesting.
In the next 5 years, U.S. defense budget is going to be the issue, the primary issue in national defense, our national defense.
Oh, interesting insight. And that probably will relate to that book topic we put on hold for a while, when you turn your attention here to Ukraine. So, again, thanks, Tony, for being the guest here on episode 3 of this N3SP podcast. Hope everyone listening have enjoyed hearing this discussion about a very pressing current national security topic and the research being done on it here. And hope that you will stay tuned for future episodes. And in the meantime, if you'd like more information, please go to our website at n3sp.org. Goodbye.